everyone, and welcome once again to another edition of The Other Side of Midnight. You know, we're kind of pressing this metaphor that you believe things more after sunset than during daylight, because when you kind of look at all the stuff going on in daylight now, you're either going to have to expand your paradigm, or you're going to have to expand The Other Side of Midnight. I want to start this morning with two things at the top of Radio with Pictures. You know the drill by now. OtherSideOfMidnight.com, upper right-hand corner, click on Radio with Pictures. That takes you to tonight's guest page. I have two news items there. The first one from the New York Times about the strikes by ISIS that shattered, you know, the Brussels calm and has shaken European political and security-minded people to their core. You may note that this occurred last night just as I was interviewing David Icke. And we were discussing the, you know, problem, reaction, solution, the Hegelian dialect, where if you want to move people in a certain direction, you know, you move them down the cattle chute, you basically make a big noise at one end, and they all move to the other end very predictably, and it's incredibly synchronistic. And I just can ascribe it to the resonances in the ether that we talk about now. More of these synchronicities are happening all the time, as we have noted. The physics is changing, as we have noted. Various people with other investigations, other correlations, other Burkean connection of the dots have come on the show, and they have agreed that our model is, you know, certainly in the running in terms of explaining the background to these increasingly extraordinary occurrences. And they will increase, and they will be even more extraordinary. So, wanted to get that in at the top of the show, because one of the things that it has done, the horrible, you know, bombings in Brussels, and I want to send our condolences on behalf of everyone listening to the folks in Brussels, because it's awful. I mean, there's words are incapable of describing what it is to be sitting or riding one moment in perfect normalcy, and the next moment your universe has been shattered, and in many cases irrevocably so. Empathy. The problem is, politically, what this is doing is distracting our attention, as we have pointed out over several programs, and in particular last night, to what's going on in other parts of the world. The President of the United States, having completed his mission to Cuba, has gone on, and at about 10:20 this evening, Mountain Time, he landed in Buenos Aires, in Argentina, and is continuing this extraordinary odyssey, journey, whatever. And there, of course, is not a press person asking him any of the questions that I'd love to ask and this audience would love to ask, which is, why the heck at the end of the trip, you know, tomorrow, today is Wednesday, tomorrow's Thursday, on Thursday, why are you going to Bariloche? Why are you visiting this incredibly significant former Nazi stronghold at a key latitude, 49 degrees and change, south latitude, kind of coincidentally the same latitude, south latitude, as Sidonia is north latitude? Gosh, you don't imagine there was a symbolic connection on the part of whoever. Anyway, in other news, the primary season is rolling on. Donald Trump won tonight in Arizona, and Ted Cruz won in, I believe, Idaho. Bernie Sanders has won a couple of the caucus states. He lost Arizona. Hillary won Arizona. And the march rolls on, but in an incredibly Republican state, Bernie Sanders has drawn immense crowds, and they've had over-the-top primary voting. Tens of thousands of people came out for this election on the Democratic side tonight who did not come out, you know, 4 years ago or 8 years ago. And that maybe indicates that people are kind of waking up. They're kind of looking around, and they realize that what Bernie is selling is kind of important to pay attention to. We shall see. This morning's program is kind of above all this. And again, it's, to me, what's going on in the news right now, as tragic and as horrible as it is, represents another level of disconnection from the major things we should be discussing in the mainstream news, which is that the human race is not alone. We are finding now the space agencies from all over the world, all the different governmental space agencies, including the Chinese. I mean, you want me to run a really, really weird scenario by you tonight? you know, as Bernie's now saying in some of these rallies, you know, do you want to hear a revolutionary thing, or you want to hear something unbelievable? Or so let me lay one on you. We're all speculating, why is the President of the United States going to Bariloche to meet with whomever? We're not told who he's meeting with. The attention of the press is totally off that trip now. It's focused on Brussels. And there turns out to be, from an official document that was sent to me, a State Department document by several listeners. I mean, I've got the sharpest audience in the world, on this planet. Because I put out something that we need to find something obscure, something, you know, critical, but not really being talked about. Bingo. Comes in, like, within minutes sometimes, certainly within a few hours, you know, after the show. That's why I stay up answering email, because you guys are the best. And gals, you know, come on, got to be equal here. Anyway, so the president landed tonight, and wouldn't it be wild if the reason he's going to Bariloche is because of what this obscure State Department document unearthed, sent to me by several listeners, that there is a Chinese space tracking station in Argentina, in actually Patagonia, in that region called Bariloche. And it has been used, among other things, to work with Chinese space programs. We'll get to that in a moment. And the Argentinian space programs. I mean, you can't be a modern nation without a space program, right? Look at Iran. Look at other, you know, South Africa many years ago. So wouldn't it be really amazing if the Chinese have quietly invited the President of the United States to Bariloche, not to the, you know, the chalets and all that stuff, but to the tracking station, because that's the only place on Earth they say to him he can view what they're going to show him in total, absolute security before the next phase of the narrative. And what is that? The downlinked Chinese Chang 3 images of the ancient glass ruins on the moon. Imagine if what we have been able to retrieve from the official Chinese websites, you know, the People's Liberation Army and some of the other official Chinese government websites. Suppose what we've been able to retrieve in the way of signal and the noise is a pale version of the real data. And they're going to show him the real data in the one place where no one can look over his shoulder. And why did he bring a whole bunch of NASA people with him? Maybe it's because, you know, it's as my Victorian grandmother used to say, if you don't know your furs, know your furrier. You know, Barack Obama's not a space expert. He's not used to looking at space imagery. But suppose he brings people with him from NASA who can vouch for the authenticity, the surprise reaction. Oh, my God, Mr. President, look what the Chinese have found. Now, why do I think this is more than just an interesting diversion? Please keep your mics all muted. Thank you. It's because if you look at the Chinese landing, you know, a couple of years ago, remember, they landed at 19.51, actually. Ding, 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 ding. Physics, physics, physics. And 44 degrees north. 44. Obama, 44th president. Connection? I don't know. But there's something going on in Bariloche, and it does involve the Chinese. And the only thing that I can think the Chinese have done that is part of what we're going to talk about tonight, which is game-changing, is reveal that we are not the first. So our panel tonight consists of some familiar members of the imaging panel here at Other Side of Midnight, and a new member we're going to get to shortly. Some of our old members cannot be with us tonight. Bob Harrison and Will Farrer could not join us. They had other commitments, but they've sent stuff. We're going to talk about their stuff. So, who's going to talk about it? Well, first of all, Keith Laney, who's a space imaging processing and anomaly specialist from Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm getting a little audio feedback there. Thank you. He's a husband, father, grandfather, artist, copper master, amateur space scientist, and avid promoter and supporter of space exploration, because Keith believes, like I do, that without space, the human race is doomed. Our next guest is Andrew Curry, who began his artistic career as a community public artist working with neighborhood groups to create murals in schools and community centers. As a graphic designer and illustrator, he services a small He services small to large Canadian companies. I'll get that straight someday. For the past decade, he's worked as a storyboard artist and concept illustrator in the film and television industries and in commercial TV advertising. Andrew has a Bachelor's of Arts from the University of British Columbia and a diploma in graphic design and illustration and a master's in art therapy. And we actually have discussed on previous shows his analysis, his therapeutic analysis of Alan Bean's art from the surface of the moon. And that's, of course, in previous programs available at Club 19.5. And finally, last but not least, my old longtime friend, Peter Voreus, who is a self-made planetary researcher specializing in discovering manufactured slash artificial artifacts on the surface of other planets, moons, and asteroids in the solar system, made available by studying avidly the images from NASA's landers for 23 years, as of course many other space programs now. Peter's pretty sharp-eyed and can spot an artificial object obscured by NASA in seconds. We're going to get into how he does that and how that can be democratized. And so, gentlemen, welcome all, welcome one, to the other side of midnight.
Morning, Richard.
Good morning, morning Keith.
Good morning.
That's Peter.
Yes, good morning.
Who's at the other end of the continent. Peter, you're talking to us from some tiny little out-of-the-way place in Maine, right?
Yeah, Old Orchard Beach.
Oh, my, my, my. So,
the same town where Dr. Herbert Hopkins had his experience.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, we will get to that. So I'll tell you what, since you guys all put this show together, and I'm going to be merely kind of like a traffic cop, why don't we start probably with Keith? Are we going with you first?
Sure, that's fine.
Okay, well, it depends on who set up what behind the scenes, you know, like links connecting to other links connecting to stunning imagery. And we usually save Andrew's stuff because he does the comparative thing. So let's start with you. Where are we looking tonight in the formerly inhabited solar system?
I think first we're going to look at Ceres, maybe.
Okay.
Good idea.
Right.
If you radio with pictures, link number one.
Link one on radio with pictures. Coming right up. Okay.
Well, excuse me, the first link is actually your item, so it's the second number one.
Oh, yeah. It's under the panel items. So, yeah, under right. panel items, it's link number one. Mm-hmm. And that's clickables, which means if you click on it again, it gets bigger. It embiggens. Where did that term embiggen ever come from? Is that a kind of a loan thing from the Germans where they just kind of took over NASA, including some of the language? Embiggen. Anyway, it makes it bigger if you click on it, right? Yes.
Yes, sure.
Oh,
does.
My gosh. Take us away.
Okay. This is the bright stuff that's in Ocrator Crater. I finally got us a LAMO image of it, which means a low-altitude image, basically. It's amazing. If you click on it, you're looking around. You see, you notice we did a show on this a pretty good while ago. Andrew did a nice little rendition of it, and his rendition came out really true to what
Isn't it incredible? Like. Andrew has got – we'll get to Andrew and his amazing eagle eye. But mm-hmm. Tell me what you're seeing, because what I'm seeing is an ancient, ancient city which has been dusted by frost so that all the geometry is standing out in certain regions, certain parts of this ancient city in the bottom of this 57-mile-wide crater as wide as Los Angeles, the Los Angeles Basin. And the only reason we're seeing this really incredible bright stuff is not because it's intrinsically bright, but because it's probably got something frozen on it that is bright and is outlining the stunning city-like geometry.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. You know, a lot of people see the striations around this thing, and they, you know, just see cracks in a crater floor, but that's not what this is. What's of particular interest to me is you see you have the two areas. You have the one on the left, the one on the right. The one on the left is the main central area that's
yep.
in the crater, but the one on the right has some stunning geometry in it as well.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Yes, we just got this image this morning, so you know, we really haven't had a whole lot of time to go and dissect everything that's in it. That's why we're just showing the NASA version. If you look on the, you know, the link that we shared, that was the NASA image. It's, you know, the JPL's photo journal. In this case, this image really doesn't need that much. It's excellent. It's very detailed, very high resolution. The objects that are in this, that are in the right side, I have no idea what that is, but I mean, it looks like a wall there. You know, maybe a former domed covering or something, or, you know, it looks like that part is maybe older than what's in the middle. What is the one in the middle is absolutely fascinating. And we're seeing now details.
Now, wait. Let's not lose everybody. We've got two large clusters of brightness on the left and the right. Mm-hmm. And between them, going kind of up and down in the image, we've got little smaller collections of light and geometry. And at the very top, there's one that goes to the left like an L. Bing!
Mm-hmm. Sure is.
Is that what you're talking about, that stuff in the middle between the two big clusters?
Yeah. If you look at the stuff in the middle, it's like, actually, there's one, two, three. There's like five clustered objects there,
mm-hmm.
Shaped in an L. That's it. Yeah, we're going to get into that really good later, because we're going to pull this up. I'm sure me and Will, by the time this is over with, we're going to investigate this whole area and walk around it really well. Because you know as well as I do, it takes hours of familiarization with the surface before you're actually aware of, you know, what's in it and the things that pop out that are actually there. You know, start taking the shape into your mind. What gets me the bright spot that's to the left, actually the one that's in the center of the crater,
uh-huh.
We're seeing in the center. Look in the center of it. There's a little mound right in the center, and we're seeing details on this that we...
Oh, there's incredible geometric details. The NASA caption calls this a dome.
Well, sitting, that's what it is.
Oh, it's a dome. But, guys, do you want to know where that dome is sitting exactly? 19.47 degrees above the current Syrian equator, meaning it's at an upwelling point. Remember how these guys have been talking about salt and maybe ice and all that? None of them have mentioned the idea that this crater is at 19.5. If, as in any rotating object with a liquid, and they're now talking about liquid water under the surface, under the crust, they found neutron evidence near the poles, of liquid water somewhere closer to the surface under the crust with the neutron activation. Anyway, if there is an underwater ocean, then like on Earth where you have upwellings at 19.5 and Jupiter upwellings at 19.5 and Neptune upwellings at 19.5, et cetera, you would get in the physics an upwelling at 19.5, except in this case, it's pushing itself up through structure, through a city, because it's so ancient and old. The cracks are from the stresses, and you're looking at the dusting of the frozen water that flashes into vapor in the vacuum, plating out on the cold architecture that's frigid, you know, 100 degrees above absolute zero, even in the sunlight. So it's the reason that Akhetar is so brilliant is because that's where the stuff is coming up to show us the geometry, which is so much more widespread than just in this crater.
Yes, I agree with you. There's an upwelling there. And we, you know, the thing about this, even on the low-res images that we were working with on previous shows,
mm-hmm.
that we brought out by photo enhancement, we brought out this hump that's in the middle. And Andrew captured it on his drawings as well. And so, you know, we were aware that this did this long before, probably before anybody else, you know, before the scientists said this was a dome. We were pointing at this going, oh, look, you know, right in the middle, it's right, it's risen up, you know.
Well, given the temperatures on the surface and the temperatures underneath, it's almost like if it's a, remember when Mount St. Helens blew and they started looking at what they called a lava dome in the center of the crater? And over a period of time, 2 or 3 years, the TV cameras would fly up there on helicopters and they would show this dome getting bigger and bigger preparatory to another blowout, right? Think of the dome on Ceres made of water ice slowly oozing up from underneath, being pushed up by forces, by the forces at 19.5, and the vacuum keeping it really a cold ice, so it's more like steel. So you've got this constant war between upwelling and tension and cracking and stresses and, you know, it, in other words, something eventually has got to give, and what you get is vapor, which plates out on all the cold stuff, which, of course, if it's geometric, it's going to show up as geometry, and you also get a bigger and bigger dome building to, what, a major explosion, kind of like a mini Mount St. Helens? Is that what caused the dusting across the larger area?
Yeah, it could be. It could be, and I've also noticed, I mean, although we're getting a better view of this, and we might be seeing things that are, you know, we're seeing it better than we ever did, so we're seeing things that we didn't see before, but to me, it looks to me like these areas might be a little bit larger than what we saw before, as in they may be growing.
Oh, really?
I mean, this is just something that I've noticed offhand, that there is more white material, there's more frozen material in this image than in most of the ones we've looked at before. Now, like I say, it might be the result of this simply being such a better image.
I think it's just simply just a better image, because remember, when you're looking down at those light levels on those other images, you're looking at noise. Andrew, why don't you jump in here before we get to your comparisons? Just kind of give us your overview.
Yeah, hi, Richard. It's funny you should say that it's changing, Keith, because wasn't there an article recently, Richard, that came from NASA talking about the Ceres lights changing?
Yes, yes. And that was not from NASA. It was from a ground-based observatory, one of the major, I forget, maybe it was the ESTRO telescope, you know, several meters in size, so they get pretty good signals on looking at Ceres. They noticed that as Ceres rotates, they're getting a Doppler shift with the white areas, because the white areas, when they move away, if they have lines that are in the spectrum from the sun, they'll slightly be redshifted. If they're moving, I'm sorry, other way around, if they're moving toward us, they'd be blue-shifted, and moving away, they'd be redshifted. So they detected the separation of lines due to rotation of Ceres. Then they saw other variation in the place of Ocator when it was on the hemisphere facing Earth. And they infer that there's some kind of variation in outgassing, i.e. water vapor, from Ocator. But if you look at some of the early Ceres images, Keith, you'll remember this. Remember the early animations where the Ocator spot appeared to fluctuate, appeared to like twinkle?
Yes.
And I thought what they're seeing is not physical emanations changing over time, you know, outgassing or plumbing. What they're seeing is the physical occultations of parts of the dome. As it rotates around, you have these specular surfaces, and it's going to interrupt the reflections, and you're going to get light chopping. You're going to get little mini eclipses, like the occultation stuff we've talked about at the Kepler star 1,500 light years away, except this is occurring right in our own backyard. But since they, with the ground-based telescope, they can't see Ocator, they can't see this incredible detail. They're inferring the changes based on basically spectral changes, and those could be simple mechanical geometric occultations of dome stuff sticking up from the surface, occulting the light sources.
Yeah, that could very well be, Richard. We know that the surface of that is very crenellated.
Well, you can see the incredible 3D geometry. Just look at this image. I mean, obviously that stuff is not all in one plane. Right, Andrew?
Oh, yeah. No, when I first saw this morning, when Will sent it around to us, I was floored and stunned, because I was prepping for, you know, the other things we're doing tonight, and I was like wanting to leave that alone and start jumping into this, but time constraints. Yeah, no, it's incredible.
Okay, let's bring Peter in. Peter, way back there in Maine, I used to live close to Maine in Massachusetts. It's probably chilly this morning in Maine.
A little bit.
Okay, now you specialize in stuff a little closer to the sun. The Mars stuff, we're going to talk about that later. What's your impression looking at this incredible Ocator image?
Well, I'm looking straight at that main frosted picture in the center, the big one, and I've already spotted something. It's an architecture that's prevalent throughout the solar system. I found these on, like you say, on Mars, on the Moon, on Titan. Picture like a hockey puck. Go like from the size of a dime to the size of a structured building. It could be small, it could be huge, but then it's like there's a curvature of the curvature of the thing, but like a rectangle shape, like a pair of sunglasses with rectangle lenses, but with a center bar. But if it was like a hockey puck or a metallic hockey puck, that's what you're going to find. And I'm looking at one right now there. It's like tilted on its side.
Okay.
You can see it's a dark rectangle. Then there's a center bar. Then you can see the pot that's on the other side, which would match it. I don't understand what this thing is. I've seen them on the sides of one of the cliffs in one of the craters that's on Mars. I think it was
Valles Marineris.
No, it was one that. They are spread out in National Geographic, and that's when I enhanced the pictures, and I found them, but NASA put the yellow filter on, but I spotted a lot of things there. The same things were on the side. I said, are they lights? Are they oxygen things? Are they cameras? But it's prevalent. I've seen it from the tiniest little thing, maybe the size of a small marble, to gigantic thing, the same prevalent architecture design, and I'm trying to figure out what the heck it is.
So whatever you're seeing appears to be fractal. If it appears at a wide variety of scales, that's the definition of fracticality, right?
Well, it's always rounded, and it's got like two lenses, and it's almost like, you know, with a center bar.
Hmm.
It's like they're windows. They're the type of windows or something. And it's,
well, I think we have something like that further on. Keith, why don't we go back to your page and continue with the imaging?
If you'd like to, we'd go back to Radio with Pictures.
Okay.
And go to Image Paneling Items. Go number two.
Number two. Oh, this is so cool.
Yeah, this is an image. Now, if you click on it, it's the same thing. It's Aquator, but this is taken with a filter to bring the brightness levels of this bright stuff down. And if you're looking at the main central area or the bright spot that's on the left, the larger one, you can really see the detail in the center that I was talking about. It's really got a considerable amount of detail in the middle of it. And like I said, we're yet to dissect this image and bring it up full size and walk around in it. But, you know, if this is any indication, it's full of stuff down there.
Okay.
It's simply full of it. But what this image does, you remember the first image that pretty good resolution image that we got of Aquator, where they took two images and one of them was a dark filter?
Yeah, that was at 950 miles. They took a really bright one, an overexposed one, and then a very underexposed, and they kind of meshed them together like, you know, Charlie Wyckoff's XR film, and they got an average brightness, so they knocked down the overwhelming brightness, and you can actually begin to see detail.
Okay, well, this is sort of like between the first image that we were looking at and this image. Those are those two type of imaging. We have the bright image and we have the dim image. They didn't merge them this time. They gave them to us separately, and which is a good thing because, you know, it says a lot for honesty when you display things in their actual manner.
When you're transparent.
Yeah.
Guess what, guys? We're at the bottom of the hour. And that voice in the background, that guy's calling us all the way from Australia. Bobby Bright. Kind of the theme of this show. The theme within the theme within the theme. You're on the other side of midnight. We're discussing an ancient inhabited solar system that left ruins in the night. Ruins that will ultimately change our world. The only question is when. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. And we shall return. Other side of midnight. On the other side of midnight, the day has just begun. But somewhere on this pale blue dot, it's midday in the sun. The sun that shines on everyone. And we're back on the other side of midnight, and maybe we need a new cut. I mean, that music, that bumper music coming back, it so builds that sense of incompletion, like this story is not finished, and it won't be finished, and that music won't be finished until the story is finished. So take us to number three, Keith.
Hey. Let's go back to Radio with Pictures, and it's link number three, and it is a color image of what we were just looking at. And if you're looking at it, you can see the color image is really detailed. It's really beautiful. You can really see a lot. You know, they send out these color images. They're not true color. That's not exactly what we're seeing. This is false color, and what it's supposed to do is show us color variations on surfaces that really didn't have a lot of color variation. And this one did a really excellent job of it. It's a, you know, once again, we're looking at the tremendous detail that's in the middle of the main bright spot, just the one that's to the left. Those striations just get to me. I can't wait to dig into this image more.
Well, they're ordered. I mean, I actually did some measuring, and there's a few 19.5 degree angles in there. In parallel.
And if you, you know, this image is not, I've got an enhancement that I've done that, you know, it's not on the show yet, but it's much larger than this. And then when you look down in there, it's almost like there's diagrams down in the center of this
thing. There's all kinds of geometry. It's like looking vertically down at a city, except that dome. I'm not sure that dome is really what we think it is. It almost looks like, have you ever baked a souffle where the souffle inflates? It's almost like whatever pushed the ground up underneath and created a bubble pushed up the geometry and the structures built on that bubble at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just pushing the whole thing up. Matter of fact, if you look, you know, it kind of looks like accordion folds all around it, where maybe, yeah, it's raising and dropping and raising and dropping.
Yeah.
And another thing that the color image brings out that I noticed is if you're looking to the bright area that's all the way to the right, if you look along the rim of that wall sort of thing that's surrounding the perimeter, that there are square craters.
Yes, well, there's one right smack in the middle of the bright concentration of light on the left of the right-hand concentration of light. It's a square. It looks like the base of a pyramid, actually.
Yeah, that little area shocks me all the time.
But it's big. It's very big. By the way, let's go back to spot number one, the one on the left. The reason that the color is so intriguing, have you noticed how the center bulge has a different color than the surrounding light stuff? The surrounding light stuff in this version is bluish, right?
Sure is.
Okay. The central bulge is pinkish. Now, what would cause only in that bulge a different color? Color indicates composition. Different color indicates different composition. Is it possible in our 19.5 upwelling model that stuff is coming up from the core, that actually Ceres has a little mini hot core, liquid core, and that stuff, that energy is forcing fluids up, including water, when it gets near the top. Remember, 600 miles is the diameter of Ceres. It's a tiny place, you know, twice the size of Connecticut. But on this little tiny object, there at one time appeared to be geothermal activity, maybe even now. Where is the energy coming from? Gosh, you don't suppose we could invoke hyperdimensional physics here? Maybe Ceres was not always by itself. Maybe it was orbiting Pluto. Maybe when they moved Pluto, they left Ceres behind to show us what happened. In other words, these images open up huge, huge, Donald, are you listening? Questions. Real questions.
Yes, they do. The more I look at them, the more questions they raise. For all the hoo-ha, we haven't gotten much enhancement done on this because this is fresh. But we really wanted to bring this out and show this to the audience tonight, even though none of us really had any time to work on it, for the simple fact that it's just so stunning. And this is a prime example. We've not touched any of these images that are displayed tonight. They're not enhanced. They're not changed. These are NASA images on the NASA website. So that shows you a level of what you would say current openness.
Mm-hmm.
Current openness, because it was never like this before. If you remember, Richard, because you remember more than I do, but I've been been doing this a long time, and that's they've always been obscuring. It's always been a hiding game. It's always been a hide and seek game, and a no, it's not what you think it is game. And now they're just putting it out there.
They're putting so much out there on the record, I think, gentlemen, because when the press finally raises its sleepy head and open its, reptilian, heavily lidded eyes and looks around and wonders how it can twist this story to its benefit, it's going to find that there's a whole bunch of data in the files that NASA is going to point to and say, see, we were never hiding anything. It's all there. See, it's, and they'll look back a year maybe, and they'll see it's been put in there. And all the decades of obfuscation and outright lying and hiding and JPEGing and all the other stuff they've subjected us to goes by the board because we have no history. As a culture now, we have zero history. We are in the Kardashian era, maybe the Kardashian slash Trump era, reality television. And that only has a memory going back to, what, last season. So they will get away with it in the short term. But frankly, I don't care, because once this discussion is mainstream, once we can actually discuss like what's on image number four, let's go click on image number four. This was what Will did just before he disappeared to his doctor's appointment in the wee hours of the morning. Click on that. This is stunning. This is actually, it should be much bigger when you click on it, but it's still stunning.
Yes, both Will and I both have enormous versions of this that we've done, but like I say, we couldn't get them ready in time for the show, so yeah, we just decided we'd just show the NASA images instead. But it's great. This image here was the close up of the center of the first image that we were looking at,
mm-hmm.
And Will's brought out a pretty good bit of detail in it, and even with it in this shape, you can see that he's improved it. He's improved the actual photo that NASA has, and that's our game. That's what we do. We take these images and make them better, because there's a lot of difference between an imaging loving anomalist and an imaging scientist. There's a lot of difference, because we'll finesse the detail out of these images so that we can see, because we're trying to see something in there. They're really not, and that's the difference. But this is just a prime example to show you, though, that these things are bright. There's a lot of detail in there. And, I really can't wait to dive down into this image. I've been resisting the urge all night because we had other imaging work to get in. But we managed to be successful in and not let this image waste our time to get to the 67P stuff, which is really fantastic.
Yep. So let's move there quickly, because we have a huge amount. This comet, this so-called comet, which everybody now... I haven't, polled Peter, but the rest of our panel is totally in agreement that 67P is not a comet. It is an ancient, ancient spacecraft, about 2.5 miles across, an incredible, sad state of repair. In fact, it's been through the wars, literally. But there's no doubt now, given all the structure we're going to talk about and show this evening, that 67P is an object. Somebody made it. Peter, weigh in. Are we nuts, or do you think we're onto something?
What number are we on, that five?
Number five is our first, in fact, I'll tell you what, before we put you on the spot, why don't we have Keith kind of take you through some of these, and then he can show you the anomalies that we're so taken with.
Sure.
Well, Richard, why don't we go back up to the top at your items?
Oh, you want to go to number three in my items? Okay.
Right, because you found that and passed that around the other night, and we all wowed and ooh and awed over it. And then I was looking through, and I found some really similar things on other images that I'm showing later. But I'd like for you to show yours first.
Well, I've been looking ever since Rosetta went into orbit, at the weird little objects sitting apart from other objects that are too bright to be normal. The background of 67P is carbon dust. It is absolutely loaded with carbon. It's blacker than coal. It's blacker than the bunkers that the Stovers were furiously, shoveling coal out of into the Titanic's engines in an effort to keep the lights on, before she sank. It's coal black. It's coal black dust. And in amongst this dust, there are these bright things that you might think were boulders. And then you begin to see they're kind of a pattern. There's a bunch of them. They're only in the flat areas. And I began to wonder, wait a minute, suppose on these lower resolution images, those bright, roundish boulders that are, 50, 100, 150 feet across, suppose they're not boulders at all in a place that shouldn't have boulders, because this isn't rock. This is made by somebody. Then I realized what they had to be. If we're looking at an ancient structure that's been preserved as like an archive, like a library, like a place, like a temple where civilizations, as they rise up on Earth and look around and realize, because we're not the first, that they were never alone, that there's an incredible millions and millions of years to human history, apart from what the academics tell us, and that this had periods of high technology and then periods of, you know, currently maybe moderate technology looking to get better, and then you go back to the caves, and then you go to the stars, and then you go back to the caves. In other words, history is a set of cycles. I began to wonder if all these bright objects, roughly similar size, were in fact ancient spacecraft, which had gone to 67P on a pilgrimage as part of the secret documentation they got from their histories, that when you get to space and you get to a certain level of accomplishment, here are the places you want to go, because here is where the knowledge kept off the Earth so it will never be destroyed, where the knowledge exists that will tell you who you are and what you're supposed to be doing to reconstruct, as the Egyptians term it, the first time. The time before the fall, the time before the catastrophe. So the other day, my friend Greg Ahrens, who's a member in good standing of Enterprise and Other Side of Midnight, he sent me a link, and I looked at it, and I rotated it 40 degrees, because for some reason they put these images out rotated either left or right by a missing 40 degrees, which may be 39. I mean, I'm not measuring that accurately. The point is that when you do that, this object sitting on a flat area near the top of the comet pops out, and as I zoom closer, I realize that there is too much intricate, unified, coherent geometric detail on this object, and its overall geometry was too symmetrical for it to be a boulder. In fact, it looks to be about a 100-foot diameter pod, or about the size of a tiny, you know, ocean liner here on Earth, 100 feet long, that was designed to carry people and cargo and God knows what, and obviously is very advanced, and we don't have any idea about its propulsion system, but it's sitting there, apparently left abandoned by whomever inhabited it, who brought it there. And that soap opera, that story, that narrative, that incredible whatever happened, we'll never know unless we land someday next to this object or the other objects that the other guys then found in rapid succession, which we're going to get to momentarily, and we can plug into their onboard computers, and we then get a window into a living history from civilization to civilization to civilization up through time, from the great catastrophe to the last time we sent spacecraft as humans to these worlds, roughly maybe 30,000 years ago, that's our best estimate, me and a few other folks. And imagine if we, or NASA secretly has a plan to do that. Because remember, getting around even with current technology on the surface of 67P is kind of trivial. There's no gravity. You can position a spacecraft exactly where you want it. You give it enough fuel, give it the right engine. You know, you give it a Dissler drive, you know, an M drive maybe. So are we looking at where we are going in the foreseeable future to figure out our own past by finding out why all these other spaceships, large and small, manned and unmanned, as I've tried to reconstruct what I've seen, appear to be dotting the level surface of this ancient celestial object?
Well, that's an interesting theory, Richard. It really is. It's an interesting theory. You think so? You're saying that, like, from all the times man has risen up to the stars and blown themselves or been blown back to the caves.
Yep.
There's representatives for each one of those epochs.
And I think what we would ultimately wind up doing, you know, to organize this, since we look at the long sweep of history, we're talking millions of years, and we realize there's something in the human genome that makes us dumb and stupid every whatever. So we would remember how there's all this discussion now of seed banks and time vaults and, you know, preparations for catastrophe and apocalypse and all that. What if we did this on a much bigger scale when we were much bigger, meaning we occupied more of the solar system, and we simply left, you know, messages in drawers to ourselves? You know, there's this great Twilight Zone where the guy wakes up and he's totally amnesic. He doesn't remember who he is, and all he sees on the mirror in lipstick is a look in here with an arrow. And he's found a diary, and he reconstructs his day, because every day, apparently, in the Sterling episode, this guy loses his memory, so he has to reconstruct who he is from clues left to him by himself from a previous night. Well, suppose the human experience is like that. culturally, over thousands or millions of years, we go through these periods of decadence and dark ages where we lose it all. Then we have to climb back up. Would we not leave us fingerprints, clues, letters, signposts, missives, you know, time capsules to shorten the period to where we reclaim what we used to do, because the physics apparently makes us really, really dumb and stupid periodically in this broken solar system?
Well, that's sure it's a concept, because, you know, we left our markings all in stone all over this world.
And are we continuing the same tradition? Is it part of our DNA that's how we reconnect with who we really are?
To be. You know, one thing really I find really interesting about your image, Richard, is if you're looking at your little close-up that's at the bottom left corner.
Yep.
This thing has windows in the front of it. If you look, those are little tear-shaped, like a deck. I guess what you call that would be the bridge.
It reminds me of a very fat and overeating version of the Millennium Falcon.
Yes, it's amazing, and I'm glad you found that and
see all the detail. All the detail on the surface, all that geometry says it's got to be newer, because if it weren't, the micrometeorite abrasion would have wiped it clean. It would be just a sphere. It would just be a kind of a lumpy thing. It's not lumpy. It's got all kinds of detail, and if we had maybe three times the resolution, if they get closer with that spacecraft, they're taking these now at, 12 kilometers, something like that? If they got down to a few kilometers, if as they come in for their landing, remember they're going to try to land this sucker on 67P at the end of their mission, if they came in over the right objects, they could get us images that would give us resolution in inches, in you know, tenths of inches.
Yeah, that would be awesome. The camera, the narrow angle camera.
Yeah,
is really good. It's called, what's it called, OSIRIS.
Yep,
amazing, isn't it?
But it's totally amazing. You guys, don't let us hog all the airtime here. Jump in with your reactions.
Sorry, Peter, go ahead.
Well, it's an interesting object. Tonight's the first time I've actually seen it. I'm always looking for those other things, because on the very picture that I commented on before on the image, I did find another one of what I was looking at. There were two of them up there. But here, I'm also looking at an object at the top part of the ancient ET spacecraft one. On the far left, it almost has it's really reflecting light on the left side, but you can see part of the other the rest of the object. It almost has like a grain elevator type of a shape.
You mean that very tall obelisk kind of looking thing to the about in front, yes, to the left of my pod?
Yes.
Yeah, no, all those things.
Almost to the far end of the actual image.
Right. Well, all those things sitting out there, I think, are not natural. I think they're artificial. The question is, are they other? For instance, that far left thing could, in fact, be a final stage, a rocket stage, lower to the surface. You know, we can't see the landing legs because they're behind that little outcrop. It could be another probe, an unmanned probe sent by. Remember, the way you do this is you send unmanned probes first, and then as your technology gets better, you send more sophisticated probes, and finally you send humans. Are we seeing that? Because this is the place where the archive, the library. And then I go back to the music. Peter, do you remember hearing when ESA last November, the day before they released the little Philae lander, they released a few minutes of a speeded-up plasma wave recording called The Music of 67P? And it sounds incredibly artificial. And again, I should have prepared a little bit better. I should have found it. Maybe M can go find it. We used it in a previous show.
I did remember hearing about that. I think I did hear it very, very briefly.
Yeah, it's called Comet Music from 67P or something like that, and it's all over the web. She says she's got it, so she'll send it over to Keith and Rich, and they'll post it, and then we'll click on it, and we'll play it, because as a background, you know, if we're talking about this object as a potential artificial object, then you got to look at all the data, and a lot of the other data is, you know, kind of confirming the idea that, yes, we're looking at an artificial object which has a beacon. I mean, this sound could be coming from
a musical beacon.
Yeah, could be coming from one of those spacecraft, one of those pods, and could be updated by each new civilization. You know, you do backup so that everybody figures out where to land when they get to the technology development level where they're asking the right questions.
Well, you know, I think it's amazing that you call that a beacon, because when I first heard that, that's exactly the thought that crossed my mind.
Well, that's do you remember what else happened? It wasn't there. It turned on when Rosetta got within X number of miles, thousands of miles of the surface of 67P. It was like a proximity detector.
I didn't know that. That's amazing. I didn't know that. I didn't know that little factoid. That is amazing.
Well, that is amazing. And again, they don't point it out because they don't want us to know about it too soon. This is all on a time release aspirin. The folks behind the scenes, the folks putting this data out, they're not stupid. They're not dumb. They know everything we think we know, and a lot more, because they're sitting on the data. They've got the best collage of models and ideas for how to explain what we're seeing of anybody, but they're not talking tonight. They're letting us do the talking and present the images. So let's move on. Let's present more images.
Okay, if we go back to the imaging panels items.
Okay.
Number five. Opens up into a large image where it's 67P off in the distance.
Oh,
and it has two little
yes.
cuts.
Okay.
You see that I rotated this, and on the top of this is also a little flat area, and there is another item very much like yours sitting right there. And this is not the same place. And this is not the same item.
No. Good. You know what that looks like, Keith?
It looks like the nose cone of a shuttle or
something. It looks like you're looking down the nose of a DC-8.
Yeah. That's the first thing that struck me, you know, and there are numerous items on all these 67P images.
Well, think about it. If you're a developing civilization and you figure this stuff out, what would be the thing you would do to those that come after? What do humans do? You know, going back to Egypt, going back to Sumer, we build monuments, right? What if you got this whole place with somehow technology still intact so you can, you know, play recordings and ancient discs or whatever, you know, the information is stored in? Wouldn't you want to save the next guys in line following you some time by leaving them, you know, a message in a bottle? When you can do what we do, go here. You'll find all your answers. Go here. And so we find this surface littered with what I started thinking in the beginning, like a year ago, all of these things that look like little spacecraft dropped onto the surface to follow the dictum, go here.
And Richard, isn't Philae Lander still sitting there?
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
And will be forever.
Exactly.
We have added, and look at the whole ceremony around naming it. What was it named at? What is Philae in the ancient Egyptian cosmology?
It's in Greek, it's love, isn't it? Brotherly love.
No. It's an archive. The island of Philae is a temple of Isis. It's an archive, an ancient archive. Duh.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Wonderful. Well, you know, naming is a convention, and they've sure
well, they split the whole place into ancient Egyptian names, didn't they?
Yeah, they sure did.
Place names.
Well, some of the first images that we got were like Babiyanath and Anubis. That's what these images were named,
and they were
anomalous.
And their big gun cameras called what?
Osiris.
Osiris, Isis, Horus. You get it, guys, yet? Come on. I mean, how they really either think we're so deaf, dumb, and blind that we'll never look at this, or, and this is scarier, they don't care.
Mm-hmm.
And why would they not care? Either because we have no power to influence what's going on, or it's too late. We're right at the edge, at the cusp of what this is all supposed to mean. And I think it's the latter. I think everything's about to explode exquisitely. Looking at the political process, we're right on schedule.
Sure. And if you look on the second cut that's on this image, you'll see it has a freestanding item. This is probably about maybe 100 meters tall, maybe.
Is this number six?
No, we're still on number five.
We're still on five, okay.
The second little cut, and it's from down in the very far corner of the
image.
Okay. But it's a standing object, and it has another object beside it that looks
like
a spacecraft.
Oh, yes. Oh, look at those, yes.
I mean, and the surface of 67P is littered. You can go and pick things like this off of them all day, but since we don't have all day, we should click off of that one and go back to radios with pictures and click on image number 6.
Okay.
And then we have at the very top of the hill, we have another one of these objects sitting on the top of the hill, and you see it right there in the black.
Mm-hmm.
It's on the top. Now that top. The top cut is a 2x enlargement of the larger image, and I just pasted it onto the image so you get a reference of what we're looking at and where we're at. What's one thing that struck me about this is if you look on the left of the larger cut, do you see the deck-upon-deck appearance that Andrew was talking about?
Mm.
It shows.
Yes.
Now, that's layer upon layer upon layer, and if you see it is geometric, it's linear, it's set out into little boxes all along that hill. You could say that's stratification, but we're looking at artificial object here. That's not stratification, that's decks.
Well, then when you say stratification, and we're at the top of the hour, so we're going to have to pick this up on the other side, when you say stratification, that implies that there is gravity. Have you actually bothered to measure the gravity of this little object? There's more gravity in your pillow when you're sleeping at night than there is in this object. 67P, an emissary from time, an emissary from space, an emissary from our history, and maybe signposts saying to everyone who comes along, go there. The answers are there. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. Clive Wright, Sidonia. And we are back on the other side of midnight. Just after 2 a.m. here in the land of enchantment. Gorgeous moon upstairs. Gorgeous moon. And a temperature of just under 39. Twice 19.5 degrees. Keith, number 7. Hello, Keith.
Sorry about that. I was laying on the mute button. Now, if we're going to number 7.
Mm-hmm.
On Radio with Pictures, this is one that I found just stumbling around, and this picture originally was upside down. So it's kind of like the objects on it were trailing away from you upside down and were really, kind of unnoticeable. So
mm-hmm.
I got the image and I flipped it around and brought it up for us, and it became a project of mine because if you look in the center of this image, there's a large square area. These are buildings upon buildings upon buildings just laid down, crushed over, laid on each other. It's, to me, it's apparent. Someone just looking at it, you might go, hey, well, it looks like a bunch of rocks. But I invite all of you who think that to spend about an hour looking around in detail and go ahead and get ready to have your socks blown off. Just go ahead and take them off because they will be blown off. There are items in here that are just, there's no doubt about it. This is artificial. No two ways about it. This is artificial. This is not a planet. This is not something that has natural erosional processes like what we have here on Earth.
None. There's zero geology going on on this body, at least theoretically. There's no gravity. There's no energy source. There's no atmosphere. There's no processes. I mean, there is a very weak hydrological cycle. If you melt ice, you wind up getting vapor. But it doesn't cause rivers or streams. On a body of this size, the vapor leaves. So everything it outgasses never comes home. So what is causing all this exquisite geology, for want of a better term, except, of course, it's not geology. The only other possibility within the realm of, three-dimensional reality is somebody built this. It's very, 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 very old. It's been degraded by erosion to hell and gone, and we're looking at a pale echo of the stunning magnificence of the technology that made this place and all the others. Don't you guys think it's kind of coincidental that when you look close up at the data from all the other objects that NASA's visited, the small objects, the comets and the asteroids, they all seem to have hallmarks of intelligent design on them? Is that
sure
just because they all are, or did they get, as I limbed out in the last segment, a pre-map, a kind of a prehistory map? You know, when you get to where you can do this stuff, guys, go here, 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 and here, and that's where the good stuff is, because we put it there. Kind of like a celestial oak island.
Oh, well, that's our lipstick message on the mirror with the arrow pointing, look here.
Yes.
That's exactly what it is, and it's everywhere. Ceres, even. You think about Ceres as you're flying along through space, and you go by Ceres, and you've got this great big white spot that's rotating around, and you see it. This is a beacon. When you go by 67P and the sound turns on and goes, hey, come look at me. it's quite amazing. And, you know, like when you go by Mars and there's, you have great big huge pyramids looking up at you, and they're all arranged with a face right over here and a great big pyramid here and a buried city here. These are beacons. These are saying, you know, like the message of Cydonia that you're talking about. This is saying, look here. You know, and it's in stages. You look and it's more advanced. You get from the simple beacon that says, hey, come and explore here, to a mathematical message that's left laid out on the ground in other areas.
So, I mean, speaking of the musical thing, M found it for me. It's in the Rosetta blog. Quote, the comet seems to be emitting, this is from JPL now, a song in the form of oscillations in the magnetic field in the comet's environment. It is being sung at 40 to 50 millihertz, far below human hearing, which typically peaks up in sound between 20 hertz and 20 kilohertz. To make the music audible to the human ear, the frequencies have been increased by a factor of about 10,000. So let me click on this and see what we get. Okay. Now, one thing to note is that simply raising the frequency by that amount does not change the rhythmic pattern. It's not the frequency that we're interested in, it's the regularity, because the regularity can't be natural. It has to be, an artificially imposed order, some kind of mechanical order. Okay, from the Rosetta blog, unfortunately, it says not found, nothing found at requested page. So we're going to need another version of that. So, M, do your stuff, and we'll come back to you. Gentlemen, we have very little time, so let's go back to Radio with Pictures, and Keith, continue. And guys, you know, jump in with comments. If you have comments, you know, don't stand on ceremony.
Yeah, Richard, I wanted to emphasize what you were talking about, how we are seeing these structures and this architecture all over the place in the solar system. It's something that Peter said earlier when he first came on, is that we're seeing a similar architecture. When I've been drawing this stuff, depending whether it's Pluto or it's Ceres, we see, is it Nix, one of the moons of
Pluto? Nix is one of the moons of Pluto.
Yeah, we go back to the moon, we see similar architecture there. Well, what we think is architecture in those domes as we see out in Pluto. So that it's stunning over and over and over again.
Okay, whose images are number 8? 8 and 9.
I think
that's
those are Bob's.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. So these are Bob Harrison's, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What he's done is he's basically laid out, you know, juxtaposed two images where one is the raw image and one is the slightly enhanced so you can see the geometry better. And it's really a shame that he couldn't be with us tonight, but his memories and his work lingers on.
You know something I noticed right away looking at this image?
Which one? 8 or 9?
The Bob's image that we're, I think it was, it's number 8.
8, okay.
Okay, what I've noticed, Andrew noticed this the last time we had the show, and that's the polygons that are in
there. Yes, yes.
If you look on that image, you can see four of them just perfectly right down the center.
Yep.
Those are polygons. And
well, they're hexagons.
Yeah, hexagons, actually. But, yeah, I mean, they're calling them polygons, of course, and this is even – they're being officially called polygons, but those are hexagons. We know that that's part of a buckyball construction, and that's what we're looking at. It's as if a buckyball has been crushed and eroded and micrometeorite abraded over the ages, and that's what's left of the six-sided, bucky structure.
Mm.
Yeah, I think that's totally amazing, Tom. I'm glad. I wish Bob was here to go over that, because you know his analysis is really concise, and I bet he's got reams to say about those. And we should probably look at his picture number 9 also to see what he's talking about, and which is more of it. On this, he's got on picture number 9. He says a tendency for straight outlines in the top and bottom section of Comet 67P is at odds with the natural model of a random accumulation of space debris over time. Yes, this thing looks like an exploded Cylon Death Star or a base star or something, man. It does. I've remarked that several times, and it does. We're looking at the remnants of a huge spacecraft, man, and it's left there for us. Yep. The bottom image of his 3, or excuse me, the bottom image of his 4. Shows those hexagonal areas even more closely. That's amazing.
Well, if you can imagine, those were domed in at one point. In other words, the erosion, which is taking place from the outside working in toward the center, eliminates the top stuff first, right? So think of those hexagons as being domed over. Think of them as, like, remember the film Silent Running, where Bruce Dern was building, was keeping the forests on spaceships because of the echo devastation on Earth? Imagine if that's where they kept their forests.
Could be. That's an interesting question, because Silent Running, you know, that got a lot of us started in sci-fi.
Yep.
You know, that was one of the first sci-fi movies I personally saw, and I was totally blown away by the entire concept of it. And
I fell in love with Huey, Louie, and Dewey.
Yeah, well, what did they know and when did they know it?
Exactly. It's a perennial question. And what does Hollywood know? Because remember, Silent Running was done by, I'm trying to remember his name now. He was one of the chief special effects people, not Con Peterson. I'll remember his name in a moment. He worked with Kubrick on 2001, and they really developed their chop. That's a term that comes from the music industry. And they did these kick-ass special effects over and over again, getting better and better and better. And by the time he got to where he could helm his own movie, Silent Running, and get Bruce Dern to play, you know, the chief astronaut, the special effects were so incredibly cool and so convincing, and basically, I wish I could remember his name. Em, please help me. Who was the director of Silent Running? And I'm going to kick myself when you tell me, okay? We'll let that digression go by the board for the moment, and we'll get back to the images, because time is flitting.
Yep, and I'd like to hand this to Andrew. I think the next image is 10, and from there on, those are his images, I believe, until we get down to the bottom. So, Andrew, take it away, buddy. It's your turn.
All right, man. Okay, so under radio with pictures, we're now at magic number 10.
Number 10.
So we quickly come back to series, and this was my first stab at getting like a three-quarter down view on what was an overhead shot of the series lights. So we probably should have looked at this a little earlier, but anyways, that was my take on it at the time. And I know I'd like another try at it, so now we have better data.
Well, now we have better data. But see, what I wanted you to do was to put up the original, because look how close that is in terms of technique, instructional technique, what's survived, what's covered with, I really think it is frost. I think there's a lot more geometry. Would you agree, Andrew, there's a lot more geometry than we're seeing brilliantly lit? That means it's got to be a coating. It's got to be a coating that only hangs out on some stuff but not on every stuff. That doesn't seem logical. So then it has to be proximity to the vent. The stuff that's closer to 19.5 is getting the upwelling, and the rest of the stuff, maybe there's underground plumbing. Wouldn't it be interesting if the bunch of stuff off to the right is showing the frost there? Because the plumbing between the main center and the one on the right is still intact underground, and the fluids, the gases, are able to flow and come up in that secondary site.
Well, if you look at Andrew's image, it sure looks like it has a connection, doesn't it? But, you know, that's not just drawn on there. That's actually on the original image. Also,
that's analysis. That's absolutely analysis. So continue, Andrew. We don't have much time.
Yeah, okay. So let's go back to radio with pictures. So we'll leave that alone.
Okay.
And we'll go to number 11. So we're back on Comet 67P, and I'm back in my Comet crush. I got a crush on those things. So I really quickly, this is there's a number there for the ESA site if people want to go and find the original data. And this image is one that you sent to me, Richard. You said, have a look at this, Andrew. So I did. And like Keith said, you can crawl around on this thing for the next millennia, and then you'd be fine. You wouldn't be bored ever. So I found four spots that I really liked, and I numbered them one. And if you kind of scroll up, you can see that mm-hmm. little fuzzy image. And then there's a reason for this. I'm going to connect this to the next image. Number two, which is sitting out on the limb, and number three, which is down below out on the limb as well, and then number four, which is like kind of what I say are kind of rotting, eroding decks. And again, I just highlighted a few things. There's just geometry everywhere. There's repeating patterns. There's repetitive grid work. And then these anomalous structures. So if we go back to Radio with Pictures.
Okay.
And we go to number 12. What I did is, and if you click on it once, you get a little bigger. I drew these little anomalous structures to try to pull out some of the things that I think I'm seeing. So,
Oh, that's interesting.
Nice,
yes.
And
that reminds me of Mary Tyler Moore's reaction when Cronkite dropped in to do a cameo on her show, and all she could do during the entire show was say, "It's so nice to meet you."
Well, the thing that stuck out here was this weird thing on the limb, which looks like two donuts and a big cherry on top. Mm.
Or a flying saucer.
Yeah, I know.
Sitting on top of, you know, or a coiled insulator rod or something with only two coils.
There's stuff like this everywhere. And the point, again, is if you just go into these little details, you get this data and just go in deep. You got to get an imaging program of some sort, but you can't just gloss over these images because it looks like a rock from an overall view. But once you go in, like Keith said, spend some time.
It looks like a rock because we've been told it's a rock.
Yeah, well, exactly.
It's all about programming. Remember, David last night was talking about programming. We're programmed into a matrix, into a reality where what we're discussing on the show repeatedly with evidence is not supposed to be possible. It shouldn't be happening. And yet it is. And I think this is the tip of the iceberg of a whole bunch of people who looked around and said, oh my God, they're lying to us about everything. Yeah. And that's how you explain the Trump and the Bernie revolutions. It's like people are so fed up with being lied to on everything, they're just willing to bet the farm on anything but what's currently not working.
Exactly. I'll get off this image, but I want to point something out. There's these this almost looks like windows. There's a right to the right hand side. I've drawn them a little darker. Just go
the
ahead.
The radial object.
I see this over and over and over again in these images. So let's scroll down to number two.
Okay.
And this was, again, if you correspond to the earlier image, which we won't do, but this is a thing that I think Keith at one time said, hey, there's a cannon or a tank on Mars or on Comet 67P. I can't remember, Keith. Was this the one? Like, there's that object sticking right out there, and it's actually got a square top, and it's got some.
See, the problem with assigning.
That's not the one, but that's it. But that's interesting.
The problem with assigning any specific function to this geometry is you basically can't. The only thing we can say is it's geometry. And I'm now discerning on some of your work, when I compare it to the original, slumps and collapses.
Yes.
And that gets back to, what did this thing originally look like? How much of the erosion is from the outside, the micrometeorite sandblasting, you know, eternally at miles per second? Each little speck, when it hits a metal surface, will cause a little crater, a little dimple. How many of those before the surface is no longer smooth? How many before the surface has been penetrated? How many before the object has been completely eroded and destroyed? And to counter that, imagine when this all was new and there were millions of people. I mean, how many people can you get in a volume of a sphere roughly 2.5 miles across? Think of Manhattan. How many people live in all those skyscrapers during the day? 8 million, 10 million? And then they go home at night? So if you think in terms of volume, how many people were killed when the war happened and this object was destroyed? And how much of the destruction are we seeing that took place after that from the internal erosive forces of a breathable oxygen atmosphere that simply degraded and oxidized every available organic thing, metallic thing, you know, made artificial thing, plastic thing, until the tiny gravity eventually caused the collapse of fragile, almost like sugar-spun structures that were eroded from within and from without until they met their match and they collapsed on the surface of this bizarre object.
Yeah.
You know, Richard, it could be that. And also, you know, if this thing survived the war, it may have taken several good hits, and it looks like it has taken several good hits. And that could be, you know, then you have compromised structure. And even with that little bit of gravity, all that tremendous weight on top of compromised structure will eventually collapse in on itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, yeah, that's a number of interesting possibilities about this thing. But, you know, one thing that we are all in agreement on is this is definitely something artificial.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you go to number two and you go down to the right-hand corner, what I see so much of is what I think are decks or the hull or whatever it is, and it's just getting thinner.
Now, this is number two of number 12 in radio.
That's
features.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And you keep seeing, like, an infrastructure.
Yeah, yeah.
In this plating. So we'll scroll down to number three.
Okay.
At the very bottom. And this is the third anomalous structure up on the limb. And if you look at – there's a really cool thing on the ESA image, the Rosetta image. There's a long pipe or something. Literally, it's absolutely straight. And it's right on the left-hand side coming out of that strange
you know, I see it. It's dark.
Yes, and I tried to recreate it in my drawing, but it's literally a straight line. Now, that's not ice. That's not rock.
No,
rock doesn't do that.
That looks like a pipe.
Exactly. So this, what intrigued me, Richard, I think I mentioned to you, was this thing up on the top. I think it's part of the same structure here.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah, and but again, there's symmetry in it. There's these weird weird pipes at the bottom of it that.
Did you guys ever read a book by, I'm trying to remember his name now, very famous author. The hero of the book was called the Tear Series, and the hero was an Indian, a Native American named Kickapoo. And the theme of the series was basically a bunch of guys, gods, who created a series of worlds, the Tear Worlds, the artificial worlds. And each of the planar facets on this little small world had its own gravity, its own, you know, environmental control system. It was a separate little world, and everything was oriented differently. And the hero had to, at some point, go outside into space with a suit and climb from one of these little self-contained worlds on a larger comet or asteroid to another one. And they're all tilted at different angles because they're separate little worldlets on this bigger constructed planetoid or constructed comet. That's what 67P reminds me of, because if you'll notice, guys, each of the structures on those pinnacles, on those apexes, on the kind of platforms, is oriented vertically to the center of the object. And the gravity of this thing is zero, in essence. So how can these objects, these structures, these artificial structures know where the center of the object is, unless that's how they were pre-positioned, because these guys had, wait for it, artificial gravity.
Interesting.
So let's go to number 13.
Yes, okay, so back to Radio with Pictures, and we'll finish the last two. So number 13, this is, and we'll click on that one. Oh, it doesn't get very big. I did another version next door, but I wanted to show the ESA one. This is, again, going in real tight, and I wanted to pull out – I mean, I don't know what to say. I don't even have to draw this anymore.
Well,
it's just so soft.
It's like jack straws. It's like a mass collection of collapsed girders, and you're trying
rebar.
To figure out the geometry. Rebar, yeah, but it's on the scale, I think, of girders. I don't think these are – I think one pixel is 1 foot on this image, I think. So this is big stuff. It's not small stuff. But again, it's constructional stuff. It's not geology stuff.
No.
There's no way.
No, I've been over this. I've spent hours, as Keith said, crawling around. You see right on, to the left of center, slightly upwards about the 10 o'clock position, you can see one of these deck platings just eroding away, and you can see its outline. You can see it in the original data, and you can see it in my drawing, which I'm trying to be as faithful as I can. You know, this was like...
Are we looking at 13 or 14?
We're looking at 13. And okay. But actually, now that you say that, Richard, let's go back to Radio with Pictures, and we'll go to my close-up, because I spent so much time on this. I'm going to show it off a little bit.
Oh, you did a gorgeous job. Oh, this is amazing.
Yeah, so people can pore over this and download it and throw it on your wall, whatever you want to do with it, because I'm telling you, it's there. And it was like...
Well, all you have to do is to take the two images, the raw image and then your image, super them. We have all these photo programs. You can easily super them. Registration points, get something on the internet called Registax, which lets you stack images. And then you simply fade from one to the other, and you'll see that Andrew is not making up this linear stuff. All he's doing is bringing it out. It's all really there, but your uneducated eye, unlike ours, won't see it. And even ours don't see it unless you look and you look and you look and you look, and you wind up not eating breakfast and lunch and dinner, and you're looking, and Robin is knocking at the door. Are you all right? And you're looking, and you're... I mean, this is so cool. Whoever would have thought we get to armchair explore our ancient history of who we once were in the solar system, and all the big guys have gags all over their mouth, and they can't do shows like this because they've been told, don't you dare. Yeah. It's not time yet.
And this is not a trick of light and shadow, because and you can go to any of the different images and find the same kind of patterns repeating over and over and over again. In fact, this was like drawing a giant Meccano set of some child that put together everything in every different direction, but each thing is connected and interlocked, and I've seen very similar stuff on Pluto as well. This is, and again, this is where Peter was sort of saying he's seeing similar, you know, not just analogs, but like basically the same architecture over and over and over again. So
I can see it in this too. They can see like the windows with the center bar.
Yeah.
Yes. You know what? The moon, to me, the structures and so forth, the old eroding domes and so forth on the moon, bear a striking resemblance to this stuff.
Yeah. That. What was Keith, what was the name of the dome, the big one that you showed in the last show?
Oh,
that,
Aristarchus?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. No, that's not it. That's a subject that's still under development. Look for a whole lot to come out of that. That is an amazing area.
And then Mount Headley.
Headley.
Yeah, exactly. That's the one that you can just see it. Like you said, you can go any spot in that, any window, any girder spot there, and you'll find all kinds of stuff. So there we are, guys. That's what I tried to put together here for everybody, and I'm out.
Well, I'll tell you what, when we come back at the bottom of the hour, we're going to have a break, and then we're going to bring Peter on, and we're going to talk about the things he's found. I think most of his material is from Mars, I believe. And there's a couple of other things to wind up at the bottom. I'll tell you what. We found the music. Let's play the music. Let me see if we can get this music. This is the actual music from 67P, which has been uploaded. It was uploaded in November of... 14. And if I can turn it up here we are. Okay, it seems to fade out there. All right, guys, it is time. It is time, more than time. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. And we definitely are going to return. Clean up and clean up, yeah, we'll stand up, stand up, stand up, stand up, be counter. Rise up, rise up, rise up, rise up and glow. This is Gareth Ike. Rise up and glow. He writes good stuff. Stomach knots, it tells how to rot. We can't beat up, beat up. we're back on the other side of midnight with my imaging panel this morning, Keith Laney, Andrew Curry, and Peter Boreas. But Peter, it's your turn. You're on deck.
At last. Okay, the first picture that we have on the page where the,
Radio with Pictures.
Radio with Pictures is number 15. I got a lot of my images, even though I have folders at home, of a number of people on Facebook that they're learning how to do this, but a lot, their interpretation is off because they haven't done it there's not experience enough in it. A couple of people are okay with it, but, you know, like I said, with anything, it takes time. But
this is one of the problems. We've talked on the show many times, obviously, before you joined us, about the amateur situation. There's a lot of very eager amateurs out there, but there's no classes to tell them how to separate the real stuff from the fake stuff and how to use imaging tools that are available now commercially to really make these NASA images so much better, because you're not making stuff up. The data's there, but they put it out. Keith, I think you mentioned it before. They just put it out almost like they don't give a damn, or it's part of the cover. They let us do the work and us define the details, and number 15 is astonishing.
I've looked at it, and first of all, maybe it's part of the dwelling, but if you look at slightly to the left of center, there's a door. That looks like a craft. Like, remember the original Star Trek, the shuttle craft?
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be like a craft, because look at the outer shell, and in the back, it almost looks like it's torn off like an engine component.
Mm-hmm.
Something, but the front part could be the bridge part.
Well, there's undoubtedly stunning geometry. Again, we have to be cautious about saying that any particular geometry is any particular thing, but I see an awful lot of regularity. I see things that look like windows, two sets of them. I see layers that look like it has been both physically destroyed, meaning attacked by some mechanism. I see corrosion damage. I see collapse. Gentlemen, what do you think?
There's even a design on the side, too.
Yeah, I was going to get to that.
Go ahead.
My friend Ron is always seeing, Mayan hieroglyphs. I'm going to have to show him these. He actually might call in. He was going to try to call in tonight. So let's move through these quickly because, I mean, gentlemen, is there any doubt that this is an artificial thing, whatever the thing is?
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah. All right. Andrew says yes. There's no doubt. Keith?
What's the scale on this? See, here's another thing I try to tell these people to do, and they're looking at these rover images, because I've seen people pull out things that are 2 inches and trying to say this is a large building. I mean, it's only 2 inches. What do you mean? this is really, I mean, as far as structurally wise, this is a very curious item, and it does appear, it could possibly have writing on the side of it.
Do we have any idea, Peter, of the scale?
I've looked at these things, and it could be 10 feet long, somewhere like that, 6, 7 or 10 feet long. Because we're finding, and going back to the Pathfinder landing site, the tank that you found at the bottom of the Pathfinder.
Boy, that's going way back in time.
A lot of these things are in miniature.
Yes, they are.
Size of large toys. So
I'm glad, Peter. I'm so glad you brought that up, because people in the beginning were kind of looking at us as nutso, because the things we were finding were like models. But when you're dealing, gentlemen, with a variable physics, what is it that defines Homo sapiens now as 5 to 6 feet tall? We have pygmies. We have the really tiny creatures, the so-called hobbits found in the South Pacific a few years ago. And I've been believing that as we're looking at these ruins on other places, particularly on Mars, that we're actually looking at different epochs when the physics changed radically and we got different scale, intelligent civilizations. How's that for a revolution?
I would think that that's a great answer. the size to me that I've seen from these, from the Major Matt Mason toys, the astronauts that I still have, and then I do remember seeing, as far as what could be a reason for them to be that size, if you look from the exact actual surface of Mars to a foot above, it's like can be 60 degrees.
Mm.
But if you go 5 feet up, it drops to 15 degrees.
Right.
So maybe the planet's own mechanics that have it, that, you know, that's why they're that tall. But, you know, that's what I'm finding is a lot of these things, they're all small. So I look at it as either the micro-robotic or the people that tall, but I'm finding also a lot of relatives of Data's head from the moon.
Interesting.
Robots on Mars.
Interesting. Well, let's move through these pictures quickly because time is flooding.
Okay, sure. The number 16, that looks like the post office eagle almost.
Or the eagles, the gargoyles in stainless steel all over the Chrysler building. That's the first thing I thought of was those Chrysler eagles.
Yes. But look at the detail. Look at those scrolls, like that style.
It looks like writing. Guys, Andrew, what do you think? You think that could be writing?
Yeah. Oh, here, I'm sorry. I was just on mute. Well, this is what I was saying when we were talking about Pluto, is are we going to find some hieroglyphics or writing of some sort?
And then would we recognize them?
To me,
this can either be writing or it can be kind of in cross-section. If you slice this thing open and look at the inside,
Is
it an active thing inside? Is it an actual robot? Is it a sentry? In other words, is it not just a gargoyle, a piece of art, but is it a functioning piece of art? So are we looking at circuitry? Are we looking at mechanical stuff as opposed to surface hieroglyphs?
Well, Richard,
the eyes could be cameras, too.
It could be. Okay, moving on.
Yep.
Let's go to number
17.
17. Lucky 17.
One person thought this was like 30 stories high, and I says no. Because it's just on the other side of the dune. That could be, like I said, 5-6 feet. It's got canine features, but if you do look at it, you will see things that take away from it.
And it looks mechanical to me.
Yes.
Yeah. But it looks like it could be a large robot. In fact, it looks like it has some kind of a tool sticking out in front. Have you ever seen those underwater drones now with the little tools and the knives and the little hands and the grippers and all that? This thing looks like it could actually be big enough for a human. That's where the windows come in. Mm-hmm. And it could be some kind of a robot that you wander around on the surface, you know, and it just was parked there.
Well, I'll tell you, I came up with a theory. The people that I've seen that were flash frozen, and I've got a lot of images, and I have sent them to you, Richard, as you've seen. At first, I thought a lot of them were like figurines or little statuettes or what have you.
Well, remember the famous Martian that was seen on the Spirit image on the left-hand side, the western side of, place called Home Plate? Remember the little...
I don't know if I've seen that one.
The little Martian figurine. It was greenish. It looked like it had oxidized.
Yes.
And they were comparing it to Abominable Snowman, which, of course, was a complete distraction because it actually looked like the Little Mermaid at the head of the harbor in Copenhagen.
Yes.
Where I had a guest on the other night. And it's as I see more of these, the other model, Peter and guys, that I'm thinking of is if we were to look through any suburban neighborhood after a tornado, the odds are we would find more toys, more toy-scale objects, figurines, dolls, dog toys, whatever, than human-size objects. And they would probably survive more because they're smaller and they're made of materials that wouldn't smash or bend or crack or shatter or whatever. So are we looking, maybe, guys, at the small stuff, at just toys?
I came upon that, but I do have another theory, because if you look at a lot of these people, they're dressed like the medieval ages that we had.
The Renaissance.
And the ancient ones. But my thing is, I'm wondering, because with the robotics on there, were there more like, these people were more like more primitive, the way with their dress. And then you get the other side with this. They might have been, these things might have been, had they were thralls to these things. Maybe they were slaves, and they were kept in check by these robots.
Guys, one of the things we need to look at is we're looking at an incredible sweep of history here. If we're looking at what we think we're looking at, 65 million years ago, the big war took place, and Mars was devastated. And whatever ancient civilization was on there then, either died or retrenched or whatever, and now we've had 65 million years of independent history where successive civilizations, borrowing from the technology of their predecessors, if it was maintained, if it was archived, if it was a living, you know, knowledge base, we could have had successive evolutions of civilization springing up periodically, aperiodically, and eventually, depending upon how the environment on Mars deteriorated, whether the atmosphere was lost all of a sudden or it leaked away slowly, I think I'm seeing evidence of cultural regression to where we see high-tech stuff and then we see big, massive stone stuff. Like, as the technology abilities regressed, the locals used whatever materials to create civilization out of whatever materials they had left, kind of like the portrayal in the Disney film Carter, John Carter of Mars, from the Barsoom, you know, novels of Edgar Rice Burroughs. Is that what we're seeing? A selection of technologies that all now are like in the same level, but in fact they're separated by millions of years because stuff on Mars does not erode. It doesn't oxidize. It doesn't degrade except over a very long period of time.
Perhaps.
Well, at this stage, until we find the libraries, you can only answer perhaps. Okay, let's go to 18, okay?
18. When I first saw this image, people were saying, oh, look, it's bones and everything. I zoomed in, and it's not. What they think is a head is actually a flat rock with a couple other rocks on it.
Okay.
But I looked at the other part. It's all the infrastructure from some object or whatever has it. And if you look at that rock to the left, look at the squared patterns in that. A lot of these things were objects covered with mud that petrified, and then they end up being exposed over time through erosion, whether the wind or whatever. But I do know the wind there on Mars, it can say 20 miles an hour, but as compared to Earth, it would feel like 3 or 4 miles an hour because of the difference in air pressure.
Okay, let's go to 19. 19 is my favorite. When you sent me this last night, I almost sent it to everybody else because, my God, look at that. Gentlemen, look at number 19.
Yeah, I'm seeing some of the same. Remember the book I sent you, Martian Landscape, that had Viking 1 and Viking 2
mm-hmm.
images?
Oh, mm-hmm.
that never saw. Well, I saw a lot of these things. If you look to the far right, it's like black, and they get like circles and rectangle, and they go one way, then the other. Well, this is what we're seeing, because it's like it says a lot of stuff in ruins. Part of it looks like it's wood or a fiberglass or what have you. But, you know, hey. That's definitely a collapsed building. And with Stuart Robbins' moxie, Richard, and when you first mentioned about the apartments, the collapsed things,
mm-hmm.
hey, this is blatant, right?
Oh, it's stunningly blatant. Stunningly. Gentlemen,
yeah.
what do you think?
Oh, Richard, amazing. Peter,
well,
incredible.
I don't take anomaly advice from Crater Counters. I mean, honestly. To be straightforward with you.
Wait. I'm missing the illusion. What do you mean you don't
think? Stuart Robbins is a crater.
Oh, well, why would we even, you know, the fact that the mainstream is squirming is why that's useful. You know, Stuart Robbins is a part of the mainstream, which is obviously lost, and they now have to create the most incredible cover story to either explain their incredible stupidity and ignorance over decades or their deliberate obfuscation of public data. They've only got two choices.
That's right.
Yeah, like when NASA started the rumor of we never went to the moon.
Exactly. They're almost, it appears to be sheet metal. It appears to have kind of a gentle sagging roof there in the middle. It's got that cobbled almost stone, almost that southwestern stone effect of the stuff on the left. But it all appears to be the same color, so apparently it's made of the same material. But I would almost guess it's eroded metal as opposed to wood or anything like that.
Well, you have a broken hollow box sitting right there.
Yep.
I mean, how much
it
more?
It does also have like a. Remember the old walls with the strapping on it of the ceilings, and then they put plaster over
mm-hmm,
it.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it seems similar to that.
Well,
but
it's called lathe.
Much stronger scale.
If you took an old house I used to live in New England apart. You'd find underneath the plaster wall something called lathe, which is a grid work of wooden strips, flat strips, that are nailed in a cross pattern, and then the plaster plasters over that, and all the little squares in between the lathe strips form a matrix to hold the plaster while it's drying, and then you have basically it's wooden rebar inside plaster. Mm-hmm. That's what this looks like on the left. This is astonishing. I mean, how can anybody... We ought to really do a kind of a test, all over the internet, put this picture up and say, you know, do you recognize this? Can anybody tell us where this is? And then we got all these responses. Then we tell them it's actually at a place called Gale Crater on Mars.
How big is this?
Peter?
Well, if the it was on, when I remember seeing the pictures, there was some, you know, on a hill. It might have been like 30, 40 feet away. So it's not that big. But
yeah, I've seen this before, and that object, that area there, is about 5 foot across.
Okay.
The little rocket.
Made for little people.
Well, but again, you can't prejudge. Intelligence doesn't require size. And believe me, if the physics has changed, you would have a lot more intelligence in creatures smaller than we are who would run light years around us. It all depends on the physics of biology. So let's go to 20.
So, Richard, can I stop you there? So does that mean Jonathan Swift?
Yes. Yes, of course. Yeah. Gulliver's Travels. What do you think he was trying to... He was trying to tell us a whole bunch of stuff. Two Moons of Mars, Lilliput. He was talking about a changing physics. Yeah. By the way, do you think dinosaurs even walked the Earth under 1G? Think about that.
I hardly think so.
G changed when the solar system was killed in the war. G changed substantially on all objects, all bodies. And anyway, let's go to 20 because we've got about, it's a 47 of the hour, so we don't have a lot of time left.
More detailed.
Junk. It's a Martian junk pile.
Yep. Yes, it is. And that same stack thing from before, like collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sure the main thing would say, that's just layering and rock.
That would be the interpretation unless you have other data which says that's not what it is. And we are seeing, even on 67P, Andrew, I was stunned to see collapse features. Big things had just fallen down in ruin like they did on Earth, except it probably takes a lot longer because, you know, the conditions are so much different. Okay, let's move along here. I don't want to, you know, wind up without looking at all the images. Yes.
Is number 21. No, there is more after that.
Okay.
Oh, I didn't see the other one. Number 21, that's on Pluto.
Ah. Okay.
That I just got, I believe, yesterday. Someone had posted something, but if, you zoom down in, you're going to start seeing detail. I can see
it's a honeycomb. Like all over.
Like a tall triangle. Real like a spearhead,
mm-hmm.
And it's leaning, and you can see like the rebar. The rebar structure. So you see me.
Yeah, Peter, you're right. This is I drew this up. We did this cathedral thing, and it was like
we've covered Pluto extensively on this image. We have I have a version on my site of this image that's the whole strip, and it's in color, and it is amazing, remarkable. Yeah. It's almost earth shattering how the structures that are on it. The spear thing that you've got there, and we've done Andrew did a drawing of it, and I've done a large enhancement of it. It's on my Pluto pages on my website there, and we've went over it on the show, and it is amazing. So, yep, you're right, and I'm glad you independently found that. That's confirmation.
See, that's one of the important things of these conversations. When I bring you guys together, I mean, Keith and Andrew, of course, know each other. Peter, you're a newcomer, but you're looking at stuff and you're using the right criteria. So why don't you take a couple of minutes here and tell us, how do you decide whether something is real or somebody's just got an overinflated imagination?
Well, I remember the one thing you had said a long time ago, look for the geometry. And that's what I do. I mean, NASA, in a lot of the pictures, especially the early Viking ones and those, they used a lot of black magic marker, and they put, if the sun was in one position, you'd see a shadow where it's not supposed to be. And the sun was shining right on it, but they used it to black it out. But you can see a little behind it, because they didn't get it all. And other than that, then you get the filtering that they do, and then you get the wallpapering. And but you know, you, after all, you can see, and then the blurry things. You could see when they're trying to snuff something up, use fake sand and smear it. And it's very easy because, like I say, you look for the geometry. And I've had enough geology class. I know what natural rocks look like. I know, you know, how things, you know, the striations and different things like that. And, you know when you're looking at something artificial.
Yep. Yeah. Well, and if you keep at it, you'll get good at it. And that's what people have to do. If they expect to see results by looking at their first NASA picture, no, it doesn't happen that way. By the way, M has lived up to her reputation. Chief spy of The Other Side of Midnight. It's Doug Trumbull, who was my friend and colleague and who did Silent Running after he had spent time with Con Peterson and Kubrick and the other folks who worked on 2001. You know, Doug Trumbull, very brilliant guy. Brilliant guy.
And Richard,
I did remember the crater there, where it's full of artifacts right on that side of the cliff, and inside it, Victoria Crater.
Yes.
It's a treasure trove.
Everywhere they go, it's almost like they can't look at something without not looking at what we know is there. Andrew, you had something you wanted to say?
Oh, just a factoid about Silent Running. I think Bruce Dern's name was Lieutenant Lowell. A little homage there.
Ah, okay. Okay, what are pictures 22 and 23?
Those are not mine.
Keith? They look, or Andrew, they look like 67P in some variant.
They are, but I didn't. They're not mine.
Okay.
They're very nice, though.
They're very nice. Okay. Just someone just slipped in random images. Okay, so we would go and take a look. All right, so we'll go look. And
I wish I could have had some pictures, if I had the time there, of Titan. That's amazing what's on there.
Yeah, we haven't touched Titan because, well, we haven't touched Titan. There hasn't been time, but we will. I'm looking
okay,
now.
At, will, yeah.
I'm looking at 23. Okay, so this is distance from center. This looks like a computer reconstruction of a wide-angle image. I'm not quite sure why this is up there. It doesn't seem to show anything more than what we've been seeing. The one image that I'd submitted didn't get posted tonight has an image of the other side of 67P. Remember how I've discussed in our model, which goes back to Tom Van Flandern, when Planet 4 was blown up, it probably was the brightest event in the solar system, not even the sun notwithstanding, for a period of time, hours, probably a few hours, emitting all kinds of incredible radiation from recombining radioactives and all that. If you loose a torsion weapon, a hyperdimensional weapon, and you blow a planet to smithereen, it probably is not very good to be within several million miles. So we see evidence of stunning destruction of many objects on the one side. Well, there's an object I sent in to Keith and Rich tonight, which for some reason didn't get posted, which shows the other side of 67P, gentlemen. And you can see all kinds of major buildings and windows and support structures and almost like, pagoda-style restaurants with roofs and all that on the side that must have been facing away from the explosion when the planet was destroyed. So we see two levels of destruction on this one body. We see the side that faced the blast damage. That's the side we got to look at for like a year. And then as this object orbits around the sun and its polar axis is, of course, tilted to its orbit, it undergoes seasons, just like Earth does. And so it's sometimes the hemisphere that was in darkness when we came by, when we went into orbit back in August, that now is in daylight. And that's why we're seeing another whole side, and the side that was protected, the side that has much better-looking detail, and for some reason the side that didn't get up there tonight. So in some future show, I will find it, and we'll put it up there, and you can take a look. Gentlemen, we only have about 3 minutes left in the show. Any final thoughts for this episode?
Well, speaking of what you said of the one side of different objects. Hmm. I remember you said something several years ago regarding on wherever the object was, it actually exploded. To the left of it, they'll be on the one side, and to the right, Mercury has it on one side, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Like remnants of
Mercury
that.
Has two faces. Mars has two faces. Iapetus has two faces, meaning they're two different geometries. An awful lot of the slow rotators, as Tom Van Flandern pointed out decades ago, meaning that in the time it took the object to rotate, the blast wave from the explosion of planet, you know, 4 basically reached only the one side and then it passed on. The object continues to rotate, but by the time it rotates around, there's no more debris coming, so it's only one side that got the splat.
Yep.
The other side has slow, long-term, millions of years of micrometeorite erosion.
Have we found any place on Earth?
Well, you wouldn't because of the atmosphere. The atmosphere completely destroys this model. Andrew, a couple of minutes left. What do you think?
Yeah, you use the word circuitry, Richard, on that strange-looking rock on Mars. And that was one thing I forgot to mention when I was doing, especially sort of in the shadows of that big illustration I did. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when I was drawing and examining this stuff, it took on the pattern, to me, of circuitry. Just the way that the lines lay out. I mean, it's probably more about decking and super, but it almost had a feeling of circuitry at times. It was just an interesting comment that you made.
See, we've got to find the libraries.
Yeah.
Keith?
Isn't it on Eros?
Here we went. Yes, here we went again. And we had a whole another great show packed slap full of anomalies that we sure won't even get to the bottom of. It's just because it takes so much time to go over all this stuff, and it's so much material there to be seen. I mean, if you're not blown away by tonight's images, then you can't be blown away by this stuff. I mean, we've shown you what looked like spacecraft. We've shown you what looked like buildings. And these are, I mean, look, we've shown you Ceres. Just tonight, Ceres, Mars, and 67P. Those are just three items. You know, we've still got the Moon. We've still got Iapetus. We've still got Titan, like you said. There's so much to go through that we really need help doing this. And so, you know, the people that, you know, if you want to contact me out of the show and want to contribute something, man, there's all kind of assignments that need to be done. There's all kind of objects that need to be looked at in detail. And there's more material than we have eyes. So, let's motivate and get this done.
Fantastic. Well, Keith, you have the last word. The end of another episode of The Other Side of Midnight. Our imaging, our looking at our real context for current human history. I mean, against the backdrop of whoever we used to be and what we can be again, is current history living up to what we were? So until tomorrow, just remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.